We're glad everyone made it today. I know some of you had a little journey, so we're glad for everyone's safety. It wasn't fun getting in for anyone, I don't think. The first case that we had on our docket, they have filed a motion to dismiss. So we are moving directly to case number two on our docket, which is Dallas Area Rapid Transit and Fort Worth Transportation Authority versus Agent Systems, Inc. And if the clerk will please announce who's going to argue this morning.
May it please the court, Mr. Harold Peters and Mr. William Dickens to argue for the appellant, and Mr. Tim Hermes to argue for the appellant.
All right, Mr. McKeever.
May it please the court, counsel. I am Harold McKeever, representing Dallas Area Rapid Transit. I intend to speak for approximately 7 minutes and then turn the floor over to Mr. Jenkins, who represents the Fort Worth T. We do submit that the judgment of the trial court should be reversed and a judgment rendered in favor of DART and the T. In the alternative, the judgment of the trial court should be reversed and the case remanded to the trial court for further proceedings in accordance with the decision reached by this court. I believe that the most briefed issue in this appeal is that relating to whether the substantial evidence rule should have been utilized by the trial court, and that process utilized by the trial court in ruling on this case. The contracted issue in this case was a contract for bus fare boxes, and it contained a section that required the parties to submit any disputes to an administrative process. The parties did that, and on July 23 of 2007, the administrative law judge that heard that administrative process made a final decision that was in favor of DART and the T. Agent Systems, being dissatisfied with that decision, filed a lawsuit, I believe September 12, 2007, in the district court.
Can I clarify one thing? Didn't the ALJ find in favor of Agent Systems as far as liability, but then ultimately found no damages? Is that correct?
Yes, the terminology used in that type of process is they find entitlement. They found that Agent was entitled to have a termination for default, moved over to a termination for convenience, and then the damages they call quantum, and that judge found that the amount that DART and the T had already paid, which was about $1.2 million under the contract, was far in excess of any damages or quantum that Agent Systems would be entitled to in the process or under the contract. Now, after the lawsuit was filed in September of 2007, DART filed a plea to the jurisdiction based on immunity, I believe, and that was denied summarily by the trial court. We made an interlocutory appeal and before this court, and I believe the same panel handled that case. And part of what this court ruled was that, quoting part of the rules of practice of the T, Rule 29 specifically, that the failure to file a motion for reconsideration shall not be an impediment to either appellant or respondent seeking judicial review of an administrative judge's decision under the standard of review permitted by the disputes clause. Then this court went on to hold, because the contract in question does not prohibit subsequent judicial relief, and because the contract itself appears to fall under subchapter 271 of the local government code, we need not address DART's remaining arguments under this issue. What the court did not do was tell us what the standard of review should be. We submit that that standard of review back in the trial court should have been the substantial evidence test. There is case law, all the case law that we found supports that if there is nothing stated in the contract or there is no statute that says what the standard of review is, that the standard of review for that judicial relief that agents sought in the district court should have been substantial evidence. And the substantial evidence rule should have been followed by the trial court.
But if you look at the provisions B and C in the agreement, I think under contract disputes, breaches, and damages, doesn't it say that the dispute resolution process should not be treated as a limitation of the remedies available to the parties?
Under Part B, the second section of Section B of number 13 says the duties and obligations imposed by these solicitation documents and all contract documents resulting from or related to this solicitation and the rights and remedies available thereunder shall be in addition to and not a limitation of any duties, obligations, rights, and remedies otherwise imposed or available by law. Now, the preceding paragraph is where it says that it does not preclude you from seeking judicial relief. We would submit that the otherwise imposed or available by law would be the judicial relief, which would be under the substantial evidence test. Section C of that same paragraph, I believe Mr. Jenkins will probably talk a little bit about, where it says that agent was required to perform the contract strictly in accordance with the terms of the contract. That's kind of a rule with governments, is contractors are required to strictly perform their obligations. So what we submit the trial court should have done was to look at the record of the administrative proceeding, look at the decision by the administrative law judge, and see if that decision was supported by substantial evidence, which is just some evidence. The trial court failed to do that, which was error. And we believe that that should be reversed, that the judgment should be reversed on that ground. And I personally believe that that should cause the judgment to be rendered in DART's and the T's favor. I also wanted to touch briefly on the issue of interest, prejudgment interest. The trial court included in the judgment over $500,000 in prejudgment interest. Section 271, I believe, .153A, is a limitation on damages, and one of the provisions says interest as allowed by law. We submit that there is no authority that would allow Agent Systems to recover any interest in this case. We have cited a DART case called GLF versus DART, which was decided by the federal district court in Dallas against a contractor of DART that was claiming they should have been entitled to prejudgment interest. And that court found that there was no interest as allowed by law. I will now yield to Mr. Jenkins.
Thank you, Mr. McKeever.
I please the court. Justice Livingston, one of the questions you just asked was about the section that says otherwise allowed by law. And I think I believe that the appellant's argument is, or Appley's argument is based solely on the idea that you're allowed a jury trial. Well, that doesn't apply necessarily here because we're the state. So the state, generally, you don't get to argue against them unless it's specifically provided by statute. So how I would read that provision is that prior to seeking judicial relief of any type necessarily is limited to what has been provided by statute. And by statute, 27.152 does provide a limited waiver of immunity. But if you look further to section 271.154, it says that the local government can establish administrative remedies. And there is no limitation on what those administrative remedies are under that section 271 series. The T set forth administrative remedies. They were required. They went through a process where they were approved by the board. So in other words, they are administrative procedures and have some effect similar to a statute. The issue is here, what is the standard of review? It's not there in the contract. It should have been, but frankly, it's not. So where do we go? Well, if you look at everything that is out there from similar situations, including the one place where the state legislature has specifically spoken on this issue in the Administrative Procedure Act. It's substantial evidence review unless specifically said to the contrary in the statute. For instance, in one of the cases that the appellees cite to, the Flag Redfern case, if you look back at that case and you look at the statutory authority there, I can't remember the agency, but that statute specifically allowed a trial de novo. There's nothing here that allows trial de novo. And I think as the court, Justice McCoy wrote in his opinion, and I don't pretend to speak for him, but I thought there was some room for the fact that there might be a standard of review other than a trial de novo in the court's opinion when it said that it was subject to some type of judicial review. And indeed, I think that the provisions of Chapter 10 indicate that the court is to review the decision of the ALJ, not a new trial. And so hopefully that answers your question on that one issue. The other thing I really wanted to point out to the court, because frankly, I still don't think we did a good job in briefing it, and that is the issue number 5 regarding the great weight and preponderance of the evidence. Going back and looking at the appellee's brief, they claim that question number 3 in the charge was immaterial. However, there is nothing in their motion for judgment that indicates that they asked the trial court to render question number 3 immaterial. As a matter of fact, in their motion, they say that they want the court to render judgment in favor of Agent Systems on the verdict of the jury in response to the questions submitted to them, and specifically said we are relying on question number 3. Question number 3 is, was the authority's breach excused? It's excused if they were in default. The jury, during their deliberation, had a question as to what does default mean versus what does material breach mean in question number 1 or question number 2. They were obviously confused. They went back and apparently were still confused, in my opinion, because of material breach and default to me are the same thing. And as a result, the jury has found that Agent Systems was in breach. If you review the testimony, if you review the record, it demonstrates that the material breach by Agent Systems occurred long before they even argue that the authorities had done anything wrong. And as you recall, the authorities supposedly started doing things wrong after the August 9th stop work letter. And that letter, supposedly after that period of time, we waited too long to tell them it was a termination by default. So because they've waived that issue, we believe that, number one, question number 3 is the question, I guess, or that the jury was required to answer. Objections to that have been waived, so I guess it stays. And if you look at the evidence, it's clear that the evidence is against the great weight and preponderance of what the jury found, and so that should be reversed and rendered in our favor. There's also other issues that we have with regard to the charge. Kind of going backwards, and from what our brief was, in issue number 4, we said, listen, we should have acceptance, rejection, revocation. Those questions should have been asked. And we actually presented to Judge Lowe the questions that had been presented in the Toshiba Machine Company case, which this court decided a few years ago. And the issue, if you can look at what the evidence was, agent was required to specifically perform under the contract. Time was of the essence. They admitted that they were in default right off the bat by not installing the first 20 machines on time. The first 20 machines never worked properly. They kept telling us, hey, we'll fix them. Let's do a spreadsheet. We'll work together. We'll figure this out. That never happened. It never got resolved to the satisfaction of the T, and eventually we said stop work, stop doing anything else. There's so under Toshiba, those facts support the idea that there was never a rejection or revocation of these, or there was an issue as to rejection or revocation of the contract. There was not acceptance. And of course, acceptance is required prior to any duty to pay under the terms of the contract. Finally, I'm getting close on time here, it looks like. So issue number three, we think that the question that we asked the court to submit as to who breached first is a good statement of law, even with regard to the fact that the UCC may apply to, in this situation. And that is because if you look closely at the terms of the UCC, if you haven't accepted, you have the right to reject or revoke. What is that? That's a material breach. There is a question out here as to whether there was acceptance, certainly of the first 20, and definitely as it relates to the remaining 1,000 or I've forgotten how many hundreds of fare boxes that had never been produced, had never been provided to us, tendered in any form or fashion. So we still believe that who breached first was a correct statement of law, even under the UCC. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Jenkins. Mr. Herman.
Yes, Your Honor, may it please the court. I'm Tim Herman, and I represent Agent Systems, Inc. Seems like I've been representing them forever. This case started in 2000. Let me try to address at least what the court raised and Mr. McKeever raised with respect to this alleged substantial evidence standard of review, etc. The law of this case is that this contract is subject to Chapter 271 of the Local Government Code. That's what this court determined, and the Supreme Court denied petition for review. The provisions of this contract and the provisions of Chapter 271 are entirely consistent, and they're consistent with our interpretation. Let me just outline the proposition that with respect to this contract, we were obligated to go through their contract dispute resolution proceedings before we sought any judicial relief or filed a lawsuit, which is precisely what this court held in its prior opinion. Now, section what Mr. I can't remember if it was Mr. McKeever or Mr. Jenkins described this provision 271.154 as providing that there was the political subdivisions are entitled to prescribe certain procedures, and that's what they rely upon for the proposition that this is a substantial evidence review. But what was not given to you was the verbiage of 154, which says adjudication procedures, including requirements for serving notices or engaging in alternative dispute resolution proceedings before bringing a suit or an arbitration proceeding, and that are stated in the contract, are enforceable. All right, so the legislature has said going through the kind of process that we went through is a permissible precondition. You have to go through that before you can file suit. Now, section or chapter 271 provides for the adjudication of contract breach claims between a vendor, in our case, and political subdivisions. And that chapter defines adjudication as bringing a civil suit and prosecution to final judgment. Or if arbitration is prescribed, well, then you have to go through the an arbitration process. But the Dallas court has already determined that a hearing before, in that case, DART, is not an arbitration proceeding. So just as this court determined in its prior opinion, we are entitled to sue DART and the T under the provisions of Chapter 271. And it's not just part of 271 that applies, but the entirety of 271. The legislature saw the error of their ways and has now included attorney's fees, but we weren't entitled, and we didn't ask for them in the trial court. But the point is that if you're subject to 271, you have a right to sue a political subdivision if they breach this, if they breach their contract. Now, let's move to the contract itself. The contract itself belies any intimation that you would be confined to this sort of internal alternative dispute resolution process. As Judge Livingston mentioned, 13B is the most obvious, where it says you have to go through this, but if you do, that is not a limitation. And any other remedy that might be available to you, you can utilize as well. Now, one of those remedies has already been determined by this court to be the procedures that are set out in Chapter 271. But looking at other provisions of the contract, it is apparent what the intent of the parties is. If you look at Section 12M of the contract, it talks about venue. But within that venue provision, the following language is included. The parties agree that venue for any suit or proceeding relating to the contract, including any proceedings to interpret any of the terms of such contract, to enforce any such terms, or to recover damages, or to enjoin a breach of such contract, shall lie solely in Tarrant County. So for the authorities to come in here and say it was always only an administrative remedy is belied by, this is their own language, where they expressly contemplated that there might be a suit for breach of contract and that it had to be brought in Tarrant County. Secondly, there is Section 13F, which is entitled Cumulative Remedies. Now, when they were taken care of themselves, this applies to the T, but I'll just read you the rights and remedies of the T under the contract in the event of default are cumulative, and the exercise of such rights shall be without prejudice to the enforcement by the T of any other right or remedy authorized by law or by this solicitation or any such contract. So there is no doubt that within the contract itself, the parties contemplated litigation and their own the own provisions of the dispute resolution process say these processes are, we try to avoid litigation. So they certainly contemplated that it would occur. All right, let me address for a moment the interest issue. In Texas, their equitable prejudgment interest is applicable to in a breach of contract claim. Now, there are a lot of cases that talk about this, but in particular, and I don't think this is cited in our brief, but it's Hudspeth versus Enterprise Life Insurance, 358 3rd, 373. It's out of it's a 2011 case out of Houston, which contains the following language. For a breach of contract claim, prejudgment interest begins to accrue on the earlier of 180 days after a defendant receives a written notice of a claim, or the date suit is filed, whichever comes first. And the case goes on to define that a claim is a demand for compensation or assertion of a right to be paid. And a claim need not demand an exact amount or list every element of damage. And again, the assessment of prejudgment interest on the facts present in the trial court is reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard. But I know that the appellants have intimated that there's no evidence in the record about when the accrual date is. But let me refer the court to at least three exhibits. First of all, Defendant's Exhibit 123 is a demand from Mr. Waters to the authorities dated July 9 of 01. Defendant's Exhibit 134 is a demand from David Evans, attorney for agent, dated August 10, 01. And then finally, Plaintiff's Exhibit 42 is a memo which was authored by DART's contract administrator, which states that on October 1, 2001, there was another claim for $950,000. So the requirement, the formal requirements of a written claim are very, very liberally construed, but we've got three of those in the summer of 2001, which is essentially when Judge Lowe applied the facts to the prejudgment interest.
But isn't the issue here the fact that the contract itself does not include or call for prejudgment interest, which may impact the extent of the waiver of immunity?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so, Your Honor. And let me just say why. And parenthetically, Mr. McKeever or DART has represented that these two cases that they rely on, GLF and Port Neches Groves Independent School District, stand for the proposition that under 271.153, interest is not recoverable. That is absolutely not true. Because in both of those cases, the reason interest was not recoverable as provided by law was because in those contracts there were specific exclusionary provisions which said the contractor is not going to be entitled to interest. In both of those cases, that was the basis upon which interest was not awarded. Now, when there is a waiver of immunity, despite how DART traditionally treats its contractors, they are just like a private entity. There's no provision, there's no statute anywhere, and there's certainly nothing in this contract that excludes prejudgment interest from a political subdivision who has withheld, in this case, $850,000 from a contractor for 13 years or 12 years. So there is the wrongful retention of monies belonging to someone else is you're entitled to a prejudgment interest on that. But they can point to no authority that I know of other than some federal case that Mr. McKeever cites from time to time that interest is not recoverable, because they with the waiver of sovereign immunity, they're no different. They're no different than I hate to say you or me, but basically that's what I mean. The generic you or me, they're subject to the same rules of law, the same recoveries, the same liabilities as anyone else. That's the point of Chapter 271.
I don't understand your assertion that it's reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard. Seems like to me that in this case it's a question of law
as
to whether or not
I totally agree with you, Judge McCoy. I didn't mean to misstate. What I said was, as the judge applies the facts in the award of prejudgment interest, that's an abuse of discretion standard. If he awarded interest and we weren't entitled to it, certainly that's a question of law, and I totally agree with that. But that was in the context of my they were complaining about they didn't know what date the judge used and that kind of thing. And so, and that was the factual issue to which I was referring earlier. This whole issue of nonconformity, I would refer you to Plaintiff's Exhibits 94 and 95. What happened here, these authorities went out and solicited agent, and at agent's risk, they produced this fare box, which they didn't test it. The authorities tested it and determined, and I'll just read from you here. DART and the T jointly conducted testing of the recommended technology and have found the system to meet the transit authority's requirements. That's their resolution right as they entered this contract. Now, the important thing is that the evidence and testimony was uniform. I'd ask every witness, did the equipment they delivered, did it differ in any way from the equipment that you all elected and tested? No, it all conformed. So that's a rabbit trail, but in any event, that's a matter of preponderance of the evidence, and certainly the jury should be, as they always are, trusted on that issue. So thank you very much, Your Honor.
All right, thank you, Mr. Herman. Let's see, Mr. Jenkins, you're doing rebuttal, I believe.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. As to the various provisions in the statutes and the contract, after going through and looking at all of them while Mr. Herman was discussing the case, what it all says is that there are, well, 271.154 says the adjudication procedures, it's including, it's not a limitation. There can be a variety of types, and we've demonstrated the types. Adjudication means bringing a civil suit, if I wrote that down correctly. It doesn't say what the standard of review or the scope of review of the civil suit is. All the provisions that he cited to in the contract say that it's either a proceeding or it is something that's available or imposed or available by law or authorized by law. So as we discussed at the opening, it's all subject to the scope of 271. If this court says 271 is a complete waiver and we get to go, they get to go willy-nilly just like we are a everyday litigant, then that's one thing. But we believe that the combination of statutes and regulations that the T has implemented, as we discussed, limits what they can do. And so it should be a substantial evidence review. As for the interest issue, I think we've sufficiently demonstrated why the specific statutes that they rely upon don't apply. I will just refer the court to the brief on those issues. As for the...
How do you address his issue that once immunity is waived, basically you stand in the shoes of a private litigant?
Well, I disagree with that, Your Honor, and the reason I say that is 271 gives us a limitation in 271.154, and in that it says that the T or any other local government can have adjudication procedures. They can have arbitration proceedings, for instance. They can have a mediation requirement first, but in this situation, the T promulgated rules and regulations that said you've got to go through our administrative process, and then you have to, you're under Rule 29 of the Rules of Practice, it says that
The parties may seek judicial review of the administrative judge's decision under the standard of review permitted by the contracts clause, disputes clause, excuse me. So when we have a disputes clause that says substantial evidence, well, regardless, it's a review of the prior proceeding. We had no review of the administrative judge's proceeding. In this case, we had a brand new trial. All the issues were discussed again. All the witnesses testified. We went through this whole process twice. And I can't believe that that is what the T or the Texas legislature would have wanted by implementing sections 271.152 and 154 and the T going through and promulgating its procedures.
I have a question. I know I haven't gotten into the record yet to see, but there's references in the agreement between the parties that the authorities' procurement regulations, Chapter 10, would apply. Are those regs available to us in the record? Would they admit it at trial?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. They are Defendant's Exhibit 277.
Okay, thank you.
And it's Bates label page 04865. I don't know if that's the appellate court's record number label or the base number on the exhibit.
Okay, thank you.
With regard to the issue number five regarding whether there was acceptance or rejection, I think if you go back and you look in the record, Mr. Herman does say, his questions are more like, did these machines look the right way? Did they have the right parts, et cetera? What he didn't ask them was, did they perform as represented? And they never did. And there's all sorts of, I mean, there's pages of exhibits in the record where there are spreadsheets of, here's this one won't work. This one's got deep bilge jams. This one's got this problem. And they went through over and over again, and it's consistent that the TE says these machines aren't working as required. Thank you.
All right. That concludes our arguments on this case. Your case is now submitted. We appreciate all the briefing and hard work you all have put into this. Having no further cases on our docket, the clerk will now adjourn court.